From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. World leaders are expressing their condolences today following the news that Shimon Peres, former Israeli president and prime minister, has died. He was one of Israel's founding fathers, a man who helped to build Israel's military might, but later worked to end the conflict in the Middle East. He shared the 1994 Nobel Peace Prize with Israel's Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Peres died early this morning due to complications from a stroke he suffered 2 weeks ago. He was 93 years old. Aaron David Miller is a former advisor to U.S. secretaries of state in both Republican and Democratic administrations. He's now a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center, and he's with us from Washington. Aaron, welcome back. And first, just your reaction to his death.
You know, I had the same reaction, frankly, when Nelson Mandela passed. And I think that the stunning international reaction to Peres's passing suggests the global and Middle Eastern leadership deficit that exists. Peres's passing is the passing of an individual who, while he never attained the prime ministry in his own right, that is to say, by popular mandate, he held and functioned through most of the history of the modern state of Israel as a seminal force in both its defense, security, and its peacemaking enterprises. And you don't get individuals with that kind of durability, vision, and pragmatism, despite all of Peres's failings, and his detractors were only too ready to point them out.
In terms of building up Israel's defense, he talked about that with the BBC in an interview 3 years ago when he turned 90 and was still Israel's president. Let's listen.
We were 650,000 people. There were 40 million Arabs. We were outgunned, outnumbered. The country was poor. No land, no water, no natural resources. So what should we have done?
You mentioned his detractors. I want to ask you about that. He oversaw a war in Lebanon in the 90s in which civilians were killed. He also allowed Jewish settlement construction to take place, angering Palestinians. What do you think about the – and some people may view both of those things as positive things, but what do you think about the negatives of Shimon Peres?
Well, Peres, I think, got a reputation very early on as a backrooms pal who would scheme and maneuver. His fights with Rabin were legendary. Probably he has some responsibility for splitting the Labor Party in the late 70s and allowing Menachem Begin, in many respects, to emerge as a central force in the 1977 elections. So I think he was a man who had a reputation and an image of untrustworthiness for many years. And he admitted, I think, when he was president, that on one hand, for most of his career, he was one of the most controversial men in Israel. And now, he argued, he was one of the most beloved. And Peres then quipped, as he often did, and he wasn't sure which role he preferred. But I think, in the end, what really gained him the kind of stature which will be his legacy were the half-dozen-plus years that he served as Israel's president. I think there people began to understand that he was a man of prudence and wisdom and who had vision as well.
And what's his legacy at this point? Because if you look at Benjamin Netanyahu, the way that you've described Shimon Peres, they're very different.
They are. And Peres had a remarkable capacity to get along with politicians of many different complexions. I remember attending a breakfast at Sharon's farm where he and Sharon, they were men of different temperament and certainly different politics, exchanging stories about how much they had witnessed, both as founders. And they had a certain affection for one another. Still, I think if you asked me what the legacy was, clearly some would want to point to Oslo as an aspirational legacy. But Oslo lies broken and bloodied, and it is clearly, if the peace process ultimately succeeds, Peres will in fact get credit for a visionary approach to the importance of Israel addressing the centrality of the Palestinian issue. But on balance, with or without Oslo, I think Peres's legacy was the journey. He saw it, but having not attained the prime ministry in his own right, nonetheless, which is extraordinary in a democratic polity, Shimon Peres was part and parcel of an extraordinary effort against remarkable odds to create the modern state of Israel. its defense, its security, and its peacemaking enterprise. His life is woven inextricably and seamlessly with most of Israel's modern history. And on balance, he will be appreciated both as a transactional leader and perhaps one day as a transformational one.
That's Aaron David Miller, a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center, talking with us about Shimon Peres. Aaron David Miller, thank you. Always great to have you on.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Looking to buy some property? Well, there's a nuclear power plant for sale in northern Alabama. It's never been started up. There's no nuclear material. The two reactors aren't finished. But there's parking for 1,000 cars, 1,600 acres of land, offices, warehouses, 8 miles of roads, and two 480-foot cooling towers, which are reportedly now home to a family of turkey vultures. The Tennessee Valley Authority spent $5 billion to develop the plant over 4 decades, $6 million a year to maintain it. But ironically, it was meant to replace fossil fuels like coal, and it's now being sold because higher energy efficiency has meant much lower power demand. Jim Chardos has been plant manager since 1994, driving 90 minutes into work every day to do, well, to do what? He joins us from Hollywood, Alabama. Welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, I'm fine, but tell us, what do you do? What have you been doing?
We've been maintaining the asset so that in the future, if in fact there was a need to finish the plant, it would be in a condition that somebody could pick it up. Right now, there's a number of ventilation systems that are running. There are pumps and valves that operate. So those need to be maintained should they fail. On a preventive maintenance point of view, the filters for those ventilation systems need to get changed out on a monthly basis. And then there's fire protection systems that need deluge valves or valves that open up when a fire happens need to be checked out. So there's preventive maintenance as well as corrective maintenance that needs to be done.
Jim, it still feels, I mean, some billions were invested in this plant. But I guess the TVA is just doing the math and saying it doesn't matter. Nothing on the other side would make it worth investing more.
Well, it's money already spent. So they've got an asset here that maybe somebody else can use. And if they don't need it in its original use, which was a nuclear power plant making electricity, and they've, in essence, the board of directors has decided to put up an auction and see if, in fact, someone will buy the property and bring jobs and economic opportunity to Jackson County and to Northeast Alabama.
It feels like a, you know, like a Beckett play or something. What is that like to get in your car every day and go to work in a huge facility? I'm looking at a picture. It's beautiful. It looks like a huge landing pad of a ship or something, and it overlooks the valley, beautiful green I see falling away. But you're coming in, and it's like a ghost town.
Yes. Recently, in 2011, we had 600, 800 people on site. But once it became clear that we didn't need electricity, the number of people that you need to maintain it is, 45 or so. You know, I've been here 22 years. I've seen a lot of people come and go. But in the end, it's a family thing, and especially for the people who live in this area. The 45 people, I bet you 40 of them must work within 10, 15, 20 miles of the plant. So to them, this is employment. This is a job. So finding something for 1,400 acres and a partially completed nuclear power plant to help out Northeast Alabama is a plus.
So you're actually feeling the optimism of finally there'll be decision
made. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's as you said, it's a fine-looking place. It's by far the best both designed and installed plant that TVA has done, and probably one of the better ones in the nation. And if somebody else can use it to make electricity, that'd be great.
Well, but what if they don't? What if somebody comes in and says, Disneyland, you know? What if it isn't the plant that you had dreamed of?
Well, that's certainly a possibility, and that's in front of us. If, in fact, no one bids to complete it as a nuclear power plant, then you're right, there are other alternatives. In the end, to be honest with you, it comes down to employment and opportunity for investment in the general area.
Right. What would you like to see happen?
Just something to make activity for jobs and investment in the community. You want to make sure that if we can do something and bring jobs to a couple hundred people or 400 people in kind of a long-term thing, that's really what would be best for everybody here.
Yeah. Well, so what will you do when it's sold?
I'm not quite sure. Hopefully I won't be driving back and forth. We'll see.
Yeah. How do you feel about the property?
Well, it's kind of like a second home. You want to maintain your house at home, and this one the same way, with the same kind of care. Only in this case here, I've got 45 people to help me maintain it. It's two homes.
Jim Chardos worked for 22 years at the Bellefonte Nuclear Plant in Hollywood, Alabama. And as he said, it's up for auction. Jim, best of luck to you and whatever happens next.
Thank you, Robin.
Again, it's a steal. The $5 billion Bellefonte Nuclear Plant on sale. Minimum bid, $36.4 million.
Okay, well, today we are going to do an 80s edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. John and Heidi Small are the husband and wife team behind the All 80 station Sunny Radio in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. They also host a morning radio show there, and they're with us now from Sioux City, Iowa, about an hour away. John and Heidi, welcome.
Hello.
Hey there, thank you.
Well, and you started this station 6 years ago. What made you decide to do All 80s?
My wife made me do it.
Heidi, it's all you?
It's definitely all me. That was all that I was interested in playing. So I it wasn't even open for discussion, actually.
Do they ever get old, the songs from the 80s?
Oh, no, there's so many. And we don't stick to just one genre, and we don't stick to only the hits. So we get calls all the time from listeners saying, I've never heard that song before, but I absolutely love it. So It's not like we're playing only the number one hits from Madonna and Michael Jackson. On our station, you'll hear everything from everybody.
All right, well, let's get to some of it. And first, John, this is a pick from you. This is the 1985 song, everybody's heard this one, Take On Me by the Norwegian band A-ha. So, John, you now have the unenviable task of telling us something we don't know about Take On Me.
Oh, well, one of the things that I think is really cool is this is a song that I think a lot of people would agree it's a great song. But the reason most people like the song is because it got a lot of airplay and we heard it a lot. But it got that because of the video. Do you remember the video? It was a video where there's a lady reading the comics and the comics come to life.
Yes.
She goes into the comics, and that video stands up today. I mean, you watch that video, and it still is amazing to me that we were able to do that back in the 1980s.
And I'm trying to think if this song came out and that video came out before Video Killed the Radio Star came out.
It came out after.
Yep. So Video had already killed the radio star.
Yeah, well, I did. We're all still here. We're fine. We might be limping, but we're not dead.
That's right. Go radio. Okay, Heidi, let's get to one from you. This is the 1989 song by Biz Markie. This is Just a Friend. I started throwing bass. She started throwing back mid-range. But when I sprung the question, she acted kind of strange. Then when I asked, do you have a man? She tried to pretend. She said, no, I don't. I only have a friend. I'm not even going for it. It's what I'm going to say. You got what I need. But you say he just a friend. And you say he just a friend. Oh, baby, you got what I need. Now, this was a huge song. The single went platinum in 1990. What do you like about it, Heidi?
Like it because John doesn't like it.
That's one of my least favorite songs in the world. And she puts, I'll be in the other room working, and I'll hear that song come on, and then I hear her laugh in the other room. I'm like, oh great.
It's impossible to not sing along to that song, and it makes you laugh and it makes you smile. And I think that that's why I like it so much. It's just one of those fun songs that you hate to love, but you just love it. Except for John. John doesn't love it, which is why I play it as often as I
do. Well, and whatever happened to Biz Markie after that one?
He actually was on. Did you know there's a children's show called Yo Gabba Gabba?
Yep.
He's on that quite often, actually, because Marquis is so. So he's keeping himself busy, it sounds like.
Well, let's get to the next one. This is moving from hip-hop to rock. John, you wanted us to hear the 1987 song Secret of My Success by Night Ranger. It's like the sound of electric guitar. I feel like there are about a million songs from the 80s that sound pretty similar to this one.
Well, and the thing, when you guys said pick five songs, well, we have about 5,000 songs from the 80s.
Wow.
We had to pick 1/1,000th of them to bring along. And we chose Night Ranger, Secret of My Success. The thing that was really fun about this, they had the opportunity to do this for a soundtrack for a movie that Michael J. Fox was in. And when they did this movie, when they had this opportunity, they were so excited about it. They sat down and they cranked out this song in like 2 hours, but they didn't call him back for like a week and a half because they didn't want him to know that they got it done so fast.
Wow.
And I just thought that was really cool.
Yeah. And what about Night Ranger? What should we know about Night Ranger?
Oh, they were just, they're an amazing band, and they're one of the bands that almost every song they did was a hit, but for some reason people kind of forgot about the band itself. But, you know, again, they have so many amazing songs. And when they put on a concert, even today, they put on one heck of a great show. And that's a band that more people should know, Night Ranger.
All right, well, Heidi, moving right along, and we'll see if this one is another one that you picked just because John hates it. This is Nothing But a Good Time by Poison. Gotta get a break from the same old, same old. I have to say, I've heard songs by Poison, but I don't know that I have heard this one before. Tell us about it.
Oh, this one is my favorite song by Poison. I actually blew my knee out at a concert dancing like an idiot to this song because I love it so much. And to this day, I have horrible knees because of this song.
Wow.
But it is one of my all-time favorites. And Poison is probably, if I had to say a favorite 80s band, it would probably be Poison because everything they did was amazing. And they were fun, and they were energetic, and they were just awesome. I loved Poison, still love Poison to this day.
And John, do you love Poison?
Oh, I do, yeah. And they still put on a great show to this day. And it was funny because when we started Sunny Radio 6 years ago, it just so happened that Bret Michaels was in Sioux Falls that same summer, and Heidi went to the show. Even though we didn't have backstage passes, she somehow found her way backstage. And there's a photo that's become kind of famous at our place of Heidi and Bret Michaels that, again, we're not exactly sure how she got back there. But there's
a photo convincing.
There's a photo of Bret Michaels kissing her Sonny on her shirt. And then there are a bunch of other rock stars along the way that when we go to these shows, oh, hey, you got to kiss my Sonny. So, but it all started with Bret Michaels at a concert she snuck backstage to.
Wow. Well, let's get to the last one here. This is a pick from both of you. This is Walking on Sunshine, Katrina and the Waves. So a feel-good song to finish with. What made you pick this one?
We just love that song. Our station is called Sunny Radio, so that's kind of our unofficial anthem.
Hmm.
And we did a big contest before we launched, kind of leading up to the launch of the station, asking people what song should be our very first song. And there had to be 400 people that suggested that song, at least 400.
How is it doing just 80s music on a radio station for business? Did it work out pretty well for you?
I think it's been amazing, because here's one of the things that we've said from the beginning is we know who we are and we know who we're not. When we started, we had other stations tell us that'll never work. And here we are 6 years later. We have 150 listeners with our station's logo as a permanent tattoo, which is just crazy. But we've had a whole lot of fun doing something, marching to the beat of our own drum and making listeners happy all along the way.
And we've said all along we would rather be everything to someone than something to everyone. So that's worked really well for us to have that mindset.
Well, I will leave you by telling you that my favorite 80s song is Higher Love by Steve Winwood, which I can listen to over and over and over again, and it never gets old.
That is an amazing song.
That was on the movie Date with an Angel. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but you should definitely see that movie.
It was also a really good movie from the 80s. It was also in the 80s movie, or maybe early 90s, Big Business, which is a great movie.
There you go.
Well, Heidi and John Small, owners of the 80s station Sunny Radio in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, thank you so much. It's been great having you both.
Yeah, thank you so much.
What a great song. You're listening to Here and Now.
This week we learned there's a baby somewhere among us who's one in more than 7 billion, the very first human, to be conceived using a new technique that combines the DNA of three parents instead of two. One woman replacing some of the DNA of the birth mother so that the infant wouldn't inherit a devastating genetic disease. The procedure took place in Mexico with the help of an American doctor because this procedure on humans is not allowed in the U.S. The boy was born in April to Jordanian parents. Andrew Joseph is a reporter with STAT, the health and medicine publication, and our weekly partner. So, Andrew, a three-parent baby, but one only donated a speck of this mitochondrial DNA. Remind us, what's that? What was done?
Sure. So we think of our DNA as the DNA that's in our nucleus. We get roughly half from our dad, half from our mom. But we also get a tiny amount, just 37 genes, through mitochondria that we inherit just from our mom. And just as a reference point, we have about 20,000 coding genes in the DNA in our nucleus. So it's just a tiny, tiny amount.
Yeah, well, and in this case of these parents, the anonymous parents from Jordan, that tiny amount was causing, well, two previous children to die.
Sure. So the mother carried some genes that could lead to this disease called Lee syndrome in her children that if passed through the mitochondria. So by using mitochondrial DNA from a donor, theoretically, this child could grow up to be healthy.
Well, the baby is reportedly healthy so far, 5 months old. But this is raising all sorts of ethical questions. What are they?
Sure. So some people just think it's kind of unnatural to have what's called a three-parent embryo, and some scientists actually really dislike that term because it's not. They just think it kind of makes it sound a little too sci-fi. And even people who support sort of further research in this area think this might have been a step too far too soon. They think there should be, you know, more studies in labs, more animal research, maybe a well-conducted clinical trial before just kind of launching into it and basically letting parents decide to do this with the help of some doctors.
Right. Because, well, what further are the questions? I mean, that somebody, if this is perfected, might be able to just say, well, you know, there's something that's being passed the mother's mitochondrial DNA that could make their hair the wrong color, or, you know, they could be abused, or that this child, it's only 5 months, may still not make it. We don't know.
It's more of the latter. In theory, this type of technology could help, you know, mothers who can't have healthy children have healthy children. But there's some concern right now that maybe the DNA in our mitochondria and the DNA in our nucleus kind of talks to each other, communicate somehow. And if you throw off that communication by having DNA come from a donor, it could lead to problems. There's been some studies in mice, for example, that show they age really rapidly, like way too rapidly. And there's also a chance that this child apparently inherited about 1% of the faulty mitochondria, and it's possible that they might actually, over time, kind of reproduce so quickly that they overcome the healthy mitochondria. So it could lead to problems in the future for this child as well.
And the problem is Lee syndrome, a terrible, devastating genetic disease. So obviously people are going to be watching this story unfold. Andrew Joseph, a reporter with Our Partners at STAT. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For those who always wanted to be writers, Elizabeth Gilbert wanted to help. Now, she's the author of the bestseller Eat, Pray, Love, about her pilgrimage to India, Italy, and Bali to find herself. She also wrote the 2013 novel The Signature of All Things, the story of a female botanist, a great idea. But Elizabeth Gilbert has also lost ideas, including a book that was transferred through a kiss from her to author Ann Patchett. Say what? We'll get to that. Anyway, Elizabeth Gilbert wrote another book that's part memoir, part manual on writing or doing anything you're putting off. It's called Big Magic. It's out in paperback this week. When we spoke at its publishing last year, we asked about Ann Patchett. But first, we wanted Elizabeth to talk more about her thinking that ideas are like healthy viruses. They live outside us and they choose us.
This is the magical thinking that is at the center of this book. It's why the word magic is in the title as a warning for anybody who doesn't want to engage in it.
There's no science really behind this.
No. The way that I've always thought about creativity is that ideas are these disembodied life forms. They don't have a form, but they have a will, and all they want is to be made manifest, and they circle the world looking for human collaborators to work with. And when they find somebody who might be willing to work with them, you know, they sort of say, do you want to do this thing with me? And, you know, it's funny because even very rational, empirical people will use a certain kind of language when they talk about inspiration, when they say, and then this idea came to me. You know, like there's still this sense that this thing came from outward in. Mm-hmm. And then it's an invitation. Do you want to work with it or not? And if you say yes, you know, that's where the contract begins.
Well, actually, there is a Greek word for this. Eudaimonia?
Yeah, well, eudaimonia is a wonderful word that means the happiness that comes when you are engaged with your creative daemon at the highest level. They have one word for that, which is a lot easier than what I just said. Today, I think we would call it the flow, you know, or the zone, that sense that you are doing what you're supposed to be doing and you're doing it at a level that's at the height of your abilities, and you're doing it in such a manner that you kind of forget about time and space and you disappear into that thing. And I think all of us have brushed up against that at various times in our lives.
Well, that's the point, that you brush up against it. It's an external divine creative guide. As you say, people weren't geniuses. They had genius. They had something come to them.
Yeah, the Greeks and the Romans, you know, they used this word genius, and a genius wasn't a person. A genius was a spirit that lived in the house of a talented person. it's sort of a Dobby the house elf sort of thing, and who assisted you with your work sometimes, and in weird ways, and sometimes didn't, you know, a kind of a temperamental spirit at times, which also I think helps to relieve the anxiety that's inherent in creative pursuits, where artists and anybody who's doing anything creative struggle with this sense of, why do I sometimes have access to this thing and why do I sometimes not?
Right.
You know, that's also the reason why it feels as though you're doing a very strange dance with something that is not the same species as you, that comes and goes.
Well, and there's another option. Yeah, there, which is, why do I have it and then lose it? And that, I mean, I'm sure listeners are saying, what about a kiss with Ann Patchett? When do you get to that?
And let's get to the good part.
That brings us to this story, because you had one of the most wildly improbable ideas.
Yeah, this was an idea that I got from talking to my husband. And my husband is from Brazil, and he was talking about this big project that happened in the Amazon jungle in the 60s that was a disaster. And I got really intrigued by it, and I ended up writing a book proposal. And I'll synopsize it for you
Please.
Here. And the idea was, it was going to be about this middle-aged spinster from Minnesota who has lived a very quiet, unassuming life. She works for a large company where she's been quietly in love with her married boss for years. He gets involved with a really ill-advised and expensive project down in the Amazon jungle. A bunch of money and a person goes missing. He sends her down to recover the money and the person, and her quiet life is overturned into a world of drama and chaos.
You're sort of poking around with this idea, but other things happen, including that you meet Ann Patchett, the author Ann Patchett. You hear her speak. She's phenomenal. You literally have this moment. You've just met each other, And you like kiss each other.
She kissed me.
Yes.
She kissed me, which is such an un-Ann Patchett thing to do. She's such a more reserved person than I am. But we did have this kind of electrifying moment. She'd given a staggeringly beautiful speech. And I said, "You're amazing. And I'm such a fan. And I think you're incredible. And I love you." And she kind of grabbed me and gave me a kiss, and we became friends at that moment. Now, around that same time, I had lost my novel. I had had a bunch of stuff come up in my personal life. I had detoured from working on that book for 2 years. When I returned to it, the only way I can describe it is that the sentient life energy in that idea had departed.
Gone.
And I had sort of given up on it.
Well, but you carry on your friendship with Ann Patchett. You exchange letters. I hope someday you publish them. But you each write each other these long letters, and you occasionally meet. And one day you meet, and you ask her, "Hey, what are you working on?" And she says,
"I'm working on a book about the Amazon jungle, a novel." And I said, "Well, that's funny, because a couple years ago I even had a book deal, and I was working on one, and then the idea left me." And I said, "What's yours about?" She said, "You first. What was yours about?" And I explain mine, at which point she goes white and looks at me from across the cafe table and says, "You must be kidding me." And I said, "Why? What's yours about?" And she said, "It's about a lonely spinster middle-aged woman from Minnesota in love with her married boss. The boss gets involved in an ill-advised, expensive, crazy project down in the Amazon, a bunch of money and a person goes missing, and he sends her down to recover it, at which point her whole life turns into chaos." And as I point out,
this is not a genre. This isn't a genre, and you both have the same idea. And at this point in the story, that's when my hair went on fire.
It's a pretty wonderful moment.
It is. But it also, you both came to believe that what? You passed the idea from you to her?
When we counted back, when Anne got the idea and when I lost it, it was around the same time. And we like to think that it was exchanged in the kiss, and that the idea, which very much wanted to be made, realized that Liz Gilbert was not going to get the job done and saw a novelist with nothing on her plate at the moment and said, "I'm going to go into that novelist. She seems to be more, you know, ready for this." And Anne very sweetly, from that point forward, always referred to State of Wonder, which is the beautiful book that came out of this, as our Amazon novel.
It's really quite something. Anyone who's ever tried to do a writing project and maybe taken a little bit too much time, and then suddenly someone else is doing a project just like that, will recognize this. Oh, I didn't do it fast enough, or maybe I talked about it and put it back out in the ether and somebody else picked it up. That can be devastating. You're okay with this.
My interpretation of this is, you just got to witness a very miraculous thing happen.
You mean even Ann Patchett? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are more. Ideas to me are not like taxi medallions that they only have like four of them and they give them, you know, they only give a few out every year. To me, you know, if you can manage to kind of open up your consciousness to the idea of living in a world of abundance, then you can believe that constantly ideas are trying to find human collaborators. And so for me, the really inefficient thing to have done in that situation would have been to become enraged or resentful, or to feel as though something were stolen from me, somebody got mine. You know, all of that stuff that we can do to shut ourselves down doesn't encourage further inspiration to come to you.
There's a lot of other tips for taking up pen and writing. One big one, don't quit your day job because it puts too much pressure on your creativity to support you. There's a difference between fear and fearlessness. You have to have some fear, but try to let courage in the door too. When your well was running dry, you took up gardening. That led to the signature of all things. So you don't know where you're going to dig up inspiration. What's the one thing you'd want someone to know who wants to be a writer?
They can be. They can be. They don't need a permission slip from the principal's office to embark on that journey. And I would say, first and foremost, to make sure that they are every day in every single way that they possibly can, following their curiosity. We live in a society that fetishizes passion, that talks a lot about vocation. These are very intimidating ideas that I think leave people out. And I think if you can just sort of forget about passion and forget about vocation and focus on the tiny, friendly impulse of curiosity, which is within all of us, that is the way. But I do want to add, too, that this book is not just for writers. And it's not just about writing. What I'm talking about when I talk about creative living is about living a life where you consistently make your decisions based on curiosity rather than fear. And that if you can continue to do that, then you will live whatever that direction may take you in. We are here to engage with curiosity and with inspiration at the highest level. It's our shared human experience. It doesn't have to be writing, but it does have to be.
Elizabeth, thank you.
My pleasure. I always love talking to you.
Elizabeth Gilbert, talking to us last year. Her book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, is out in paperback this week. I am going to be a backup singer for Bruce Springsteen. It's going to happen.
There is a vice presidential debate next week. There's also a debate in California between two Democrats running to replace Barbara Boxer in the U.S. Senate. The state's Attorney General, Kamala Harris, and Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez are the candidates. It is the first time that both candidates for a Senate seat in California are Democrats. Joining us for this week's Senate Tracker from San Francisco is Scott Schaefer, senior editor at KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, for people who have not been following this race, why are there two Democrats?
Well, this is a made-in-California election. A few years ago, the voters here passed Proposition 14, which created a top-two primary system. So for all legislative races, the top-two finishers in the primary go on to November. So we don't have a Democratic and a Republican nominee or a Green Party nominee. It's the top-two finishers, regardless of party. And so this is the first open seat for a U.S. Senate seat under this system, and the top-two finishers were both Democrats. So that's who's facing off in November.
And there are more firsts here. Loretta Sanchez would be the first Latina in the U.S. Senate if she's elected. Kamala Harris, the first female, first African-American, and first South Asian-American Attorney General for California. Let's listen to a little bit of her speaking at a town hall this summer at the California Labor Federation Biennial Convention. She touched on a number of issues, including the drought.
Despite the climate deniers in Washington, D.C., climate change is real. We in California have been the canary in the coal mine, and I believe we are the solution. We have been experiencing a drought for years. The country needs to be smarter and can look at California as a leader on how we do that.
Scott, tell us more about Kamala Harris and what other issues have come up with her.
Well, as you heard in that clip, Jeremy, she is really running against Donald Trump in some ways. Of course, he's very unpopular in deep blue California. And so she's been using some of those national kinds of issues, immigration reform, to get attention and to really run on. She, you know, she's been attorney general for a few years now. She was district attorney of San Francisco before that. She's against the death penalty, which is somewhat unusual for attorneys general. And she's also got sort of a rising star profile. She's somebody who people see as a comer, somebody who could eventually be on a ticket, say, a vice presidential ticket. Her name was kicked around even for the U.S. Supreme Court, which I never took seriously. But nonetheless, she's very connected to the Obama administration and to the Democratic establishment. Both Obama and Biden, as well as Governor Jerry Brown and the lieutenant governor out here, have all endorsed her. So she's very well connected.
What about Hillary Clinton? Has Hillary Clinton made an endorsement in this race?
I don't believe she has. Actually, Kamala Harris's sister works for Hillary Clinton. But, you know, Kamala Harris was a early supporter of Barack Obama in 2008. Hmm. And my guess is that, you know, the Clintons haven't forgotten that. Not that they – that's not necessarily why they're not involved. But I can also imagine they don't want to get involved in what's essentially, you know, a fight between two Democrats.
All right. Well, let's hear about the other Democrat, Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez, who represents California's 46th Congressional District. Amazing how many they have in California. She is in her ninth term, and here she is on the House floor recently calling for an expansion of social programs to help families.
These families struggle to feed themselves and their children. They struggle to save for home. They struggle to live the American dream that we all yearn for. And that's unacceptable. That's why I support expanding programs, which I believe help and provide a social safety net.
What more should we know about Loretta Sanchez?
Well, you know, she's very passionate. She's very authentic to her supporters. She's not very scripted. She's the daughter, Sanchez is, of Mexican immigrants. She's also a member of the House Committees on Homeland Security and Defense Committee as well. And she's also known out here for a little of that, the flip side of that authenticity and the lack of being scripted. She shoots from the hip a bit, and she's gotten into some trouble over that. She's offended Native Americans with one comment she made and Muslims with another. So she does get in trouble with her tongue sometimes.
I noticed she was endorsed by a Republican member of Congress in California, Daryl Issa. How do you explain that?
Well, he's actually the only Republican member of Congress who has endorsed her. You know, because there's no Republican running for the U.S. Senate, it's kind of a dilemma for Republicans. What do we do? I mean, in terms of voters, 12% of Republicans volunteered in the last field poll that they wouldn't vote for either one of them. Hmm. And so most Republican members of Congress have taken a pass on the race. Issa is an exception. You know, he's got had a tough primary in June. He actually barely came out on top. His district is changing. There's more Latinos. And so while he's not necessarily on the short list of endangered Republicans, he may have calculated that embracing a Latina Democrat would help him in his reelection bid.
What are the polls saying about this Senate race?
We had three polls in the past week, and they showed very different things. I mentioned that field poll. That's sort of the gold standard in California. And it showed Kamala Harris winning by 22 points, leading by 22 points. But then we had an LA Times poll that showed her up by 14, and a Public Policy Institute of California poll had her up by just 7. So that's a huge spread, and no one's really sure exactly what accounts for that.
But one thing we do know is it'll be a Democrat in the Senate from California after this election is over. And a woman. Scott Schaefer, senior editor at KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.